Hi, and welcome to our current episode of the podcast on negotiation today on a super exciting topic of ransomware negotiations. We're going to be talking about how to negotiate with the bad guys. And our experts today are Pim Teckenberg, who is the managing director of Northway Cybersecurity, Northway Investigations, if I remember correctly. Pim, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Pim, you brought a secret guest with you. Why don't you introduce Boris to our listeners and viewers?
Yeah, I will do so. Thank you. Yeah, so he's actually working for Northwave, Boris, but he doesn't want to be known in the outside world. And that has to do with the fact that negotiations with ransomware threat actors mainly reside in Russia and have close connection with also intelligence services in Russia. And therefore, we know that the opponents are very highly skilled, and we don't want to fear them, but we also don't want to make it a little bit tempting for them to go after us. And that's the reason why we call our colleague Boris today.
Boris, great to have you with us as well.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
All right. So how did it all start for you guys? Ransomware, the topic of ransomware and ransomware negotiations is new and unfortunately also growing in terms of interest. But how did this adventure start for you guys?
Yeah, maybe to give that sort of a kickstart, I think it started around five years ago. We are a cybersecurity company, and one of the things we do is help organizations who are attacked by cyber criminals. And years ago, ransomware was the upcoming threat. And ransomware basically means that hackers are able to hack your organization before they encrypt your environment, encrypt all your files and your systems. They will exfiltrate, so copy a lot of sensitive data and try to actually delete your backups. So that those are the three main indicators of a ransomware attack. And we were helping our first clients who faced a ransomware attack, especially in the early days, the backups were not very sufficient, and therefore there was no other alternative than actually reach out to the threat actors and try to negotiate with them amount of money and see if we could get a decryptor. And that's how it basically started.
All right, great. That's great to hear. It's good to have experts on our sides in such cases who know not only the technical side but also the negotiation side. I would love to find out a little bit more about, you know, how does a ransomware attack start? And so what are the ways how criminals can get into the organization, to the system of the organization? Are there different types, or is it always the same way? And how do they create a lever when they start pushing for a ransom?
Yeah, that's a quite good question. What we try to do is simplify the world to make it a little bit better understandable for especially senior management as well. Is every digital attack contains of three different stages: the in phase, the through phase, and the out phase. And the in phase is the exact phase where the threat actor tried to get initial access to a system or an account of the organization. And they have mainly three options how to do so. One is misuse a vulnerable password. So the password has been leaked before. It's easy to guess because it has too few characters, or it's too simple. It's a simple word.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Exactly. Those examples we all know, summer 2024, and other examples. Second one is phishing. So people are sent a lot of emails where they either need to click on a link and then they will automatically be transferred to a website and they will be requested to actually log in. It mimics a real website which looks very familiar to you. Or there's an attachment connected to the email. And once you open that, you will basically install sort of a backdoor for the threat actor, so malicious software. And the third option, how they do it, is misusing vulnerabilities of systems. Every software has by default vulnerabilities in there, and in a period in time they will be found, and the suppliers of the software will fix it with updates, but not everybody knows about the update and the vulnerability, or they're too late with updating their systems, and then they have access to the environment. So that's the in phase, and then afterwards they try to actually go to the crown jewels. So they do some lateral movement, as we call it, and try to escalate their privileges, because most of the cases they have like a basic account, but they need an account with more privileges, an admin account or a domain admin account. And once they have done that, then they can actually achieve their objectives. And those are, as I already mentioned, steal a lot of sensitive data, delete backups, and encrypt the files and systems. And if they are successful in those three, then the chances are quite likely that you will reach out to them and come to an agreement with them.
Yeah. Okay. This has been awesome, Pim. I'm a very curious individual, but I've never been exposed to a ransomware attack. But it seems to me that there are two ways of moving on with this. One is, you know, to somehow solve it on the IT level. Okay, once data is stolen, then it's stolen, right? I mean, there is nothing to be solved. But let's say once systems are encrypted, there is a positive probability, I think, or maybe not. We're going to talk about it in a second, that the IT guys, you know, or you help them somehow encrypt or decrypt, right? Decrypt the data. And the other one is, okay, when this doesn't work, then I guess we need to either pay or negotiate and then pay. Yeah? What is the split between these two resolution paths?
Yeah, that has been changed over the years, luckily in a positive way. I think in the early days, maybe 8 out of 10 needed to pay to actually get the decryptor, because they either didn't have any backups, or they did not understand the fact that threat actors were deleting backups. So they were just connected to the network. And once, for example, they hacked the systems and encrypted systems, they also encrypted the backups, or they were able to delete it. But the majority of, especially the larger organizations, have quite adequate backup solutions in place, offline backups, for example, and they have, in most cases, an alternative and restore from backups, which is quite a good thing, because then at least you don't need to reach out to buy the decryptor to decrypt systems. The only question still is open then, what kind of data has been stolen from my organization, and how do I value that if that will be leaked on the internet, the dark web, by the way, and what would be the impact if people notice this? And that's a quite hard question to answer. I think that differs from the data, but especially as well to the organization. How do they value that? And what is their assessment of that? And they definitely need to do that on their own. So those could be the two reasons why you would consider coming to an agreement with the threat actors.
And what would be the share? How would you say, you know, how often does it occur? Let's say attack attempts or successful, maybe not attempts, successful attacks. Yeah, they get in and do some bad stuff, yeah, or evil things with the IT systems. The cases when companies indeed need support or try to negotiate and then ultimately end up, paying a certain amount of money in exchange for, you know, receiving the data back or receiving a decryptor.
Yeah, I would say that once we are called, I'm already happy, because then at least they call in professional help, because it's an expertise. If there is a fire, you're not going to actually
call a doctor.
You call the fire department, right? Yes. And I think that's the same. In those cases, I think that in all the cases, we advise to actually reach out to the threat actor to at least get more information to make your assessment, nevertheless, what your current situation is. I think that in 50% of the cases, their companies are still doing a payment. And I think that from that 50%, 4 out of 5 will pay, because they don't want the data to be leaked. And only 1 out of 5 need the decryptor. So I think basically around 10% might need a decryptor, and the rest does this consider this for other reasons.
Ah, got it. Yes, that makes sense. So, what kind of amounts are we talking about here, Pim? Just a rough indication, are we talking about, you know, 1 Bitcoin? Are we talking about 100 Bitcoins?
Yeah, we have all the cases. So what they basically do is the more mature groups, they try to figure out the revenue, the annual revenue of the organization. And typically they go for between, I think, 2 to 3% of the annual revenue as an asking price, as a starting point of that revenue. And then it's up to the negotiators, what they could reach. So we're talking literally not about thousands of euros, but millions of euros. Yeah.
Wow. 2% of the, so such, let's say, I can imagine that, you know, the most vulnerable are probably strong SMEs. Yeah. So SMEs probably with revenues of, let's say, 100 to several hundred million. Yeah. So taking 2% out of that, we're talking about 2 to 5 million, right? Am I right? Is that the right number?
Yeah, I see some sparkling in your eyes. So apparently it's quite, and this is intriguing. So you're totally right. I think that if the organizations are smaller, it's not quite likely that the professional threat actors come after them, because it's then still a lot of work with not a lot of return on investment.
Right.
If the organizations are much bigger, just over a couple of billions of revenue, then they are likely better protected. So the payouts will be fewer. And so the other ones are exactly in between. And then they also are looking for organizations who, for example, have an important role in a supply chain, logistic organization, yeah, for example, or organizations who are service providers, especially IT service providers are one of the main targets they go after. Because if you hit an IT service provider, you basically hit all their clients as well. So you see that they aim for certain organizations so that it's more likely that they are successful and that the organizations tend to pay. And yeah, we've done payments from a couple of 10,000s to millions.
Wow, this is amazing. I have a follow-up question, maybe for Boris. When we look at the process, when you guys are called in, the fire is burning, and the fire is burning, the companies recognize, oops, wow, we have a problem. Yes, we don't know how to solve ourselves. Let's call the experts. Yes, they call you guys, and you get involved in the process. Can you could you maybe describe how your engagement at the client looks like, how it works? Maybe you have a specific case in mind that you could use to illustrate the process of your engagement, let's say the negotiation, from engaging in a negotiation to a resolution.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in general, we actually always work with two negotiators per case. So one negotiator is the contact for the board or the client or the victim organization. The other negotiator will actually talk to or write to the threat actor. And most of the time, we divide that clearly. And we do that because it takes it's better to always do the 4I principle. So we can discuss, we can think about the strategy. And at the same time, it also reduces the stress, which can be there, of course, for both sides, for either the client or in the communication with the threat actor. So basically, we separate the roles. And if I talk about the communication with the threat actor, what we do first, before we even start the negotiations or the threat actor communications, as we call it, we need to know the strategy, what is needed. Who am I as a negotiator, for example? Am I someone from the company? Because normally we don't say that, you know, we're a separate negotiator, professional negotiator. So you've got to find a way to actually find an identity which is plausible and effective in the communication. So that's all you do before you even start communicating with a threat actor. Once that is clear, then you just, you know, say hello or whatever you do and whatever you say to make contact, of course. And then quite soon after that, we want to know some things. We want to know if the threat actor is able to decrypt systems. We want to know what kind of data he or she has stolen. And we want to know the amount is that the threat actor actually asked. As Pim said, you know, sometimes it's 1-2% of the annual revenue. But those are the things you want to know as a company before you can actually go further, because you're in a crisis and you always have a lack of information. So we do not always negotiate to get actually an agreement. But we also start the negotiations to gather more information to provide it to our client. So, you know, that those are always the first steps we take.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can add on that, Remy, if that's okay.
Sure.
We are not doing only negotiations. So we are a cybersecurity company. So if we help an organization, we will deploy a team physically on site with a crisis manager, with recovery experts, with forensic investigators. So we help them in investigating what happened, how got the threat actor access, what did he do, what kind of backdoors were there. It's quite important to understand exactly what happened there. Secondly, we help them to recover, to get a strategy how to recover, and both of them have a relation with each other. If you know what happened, you know what to fix and what to make better. But for example, as well, if you have a backup and you put a backup back from a week ago and the forensic investigation reveals that threat actor was already there for 3 weeks, yeah, then it's not that good of an idea to do so, or you need to come up with different additional measures. And we start the negotiations, and the negotiations will help in the recovery and also understanding what happened, because sometimes in the outcome, they will explain what they have done, and vice versa. So the forensic investigation can, for example, reveal if data has been stolen, where it has been uploaded to, so that we get a sort of an idea how trustworthy the threat actor is if he make some kind of statements about that.
Yes, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense, right? We don't want to pay out all those Bitcoins to people who claim to have done something that they haven't, right? Or when it only makes sense to estimate the full scope of a threat or the full spectrum of the threat if we verify the information at the source. By the way, we have a question from our listeners and viewers right now from Linus, by the way, based in the Netherlands. And we encourage all other viewers and listeners to put up their questions in the comments. We'll try to address as many of them as we can throughout our show. But the first question is, how does it work? Are these negotiations over phone or always email, text? How do the interactions work?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks, Linus, for that. In general, most of the time, it's over text or email or on the chat page of the threat actor, written text. But sometimes the threat actor calls the client, for example, because they want to threaten them or put more pressure on them. So then they reach out that way. But sometimes we're not in there in between, you know, so we cannot actually pick up the phone. But we actually had a case where we in the end contacted the threat actor and had the threat actor on the phone, and I think Pim can maybe tell a bit more, because I know he knows that case a bit better than I do.
Yeah, I can do so. So maybe to elaborate on that, because I could imagine that an interesting question is, how do you know how to reach out to the threat actor? I think that was one of your questions. Once the threat actor starts encrypting the systems, they also will leave a text message. It's literally a text message, a text note with instructions. It says, hello, we are this organization. We've hacked you. We've stolen your data, with a lot of instructions, but also specifically, most of the times, either the email address to contact them or the URL, the website where you can go to in the dark web to have a login portal. And then it has a unique code in the text file, which you can enter, and then you will enter like a sort of basic chat functionality. And sometimes they have spiffy websites with some overviews of stolen data, and you can upload encrypted files and it will decrypt it for you, or a timer in there, how much time you have. So it depends from group to group. There are all kinds of different groups, but that's how you could actually reach out to them. Yeah, in the case was referring to was a case. It was a case of a big organization in Germany. It was already, I think, over two years ago, with the Conti ransomware group. And the Conti ransomware group had some issues with their own platform, so it was down. And we were in the middle of the negotiations and came to the point that we were close to an agreement. And then one of their negotiators, because they have specialized negotiators as well, reached out by phone to the front office. It was connected to the CEO, and the CEO thought it was wise to actually give the phone to us to have the conversation. And so I did so. And what happened then was quite strange to me, because one way or the other, I thought that I was talking to men. And then it appears to be that it was a woman, and she called herself Melissa. It was a quite nice conversation, and I had some time to ask her additional questions to better understand what her role was and how she operated and how she thought she would come to an agreement. And that provided with very, very valuable insights to understand better how these threat actors operate, and especially the negotiators as well.
Wow. The longer I talk with you guys, the longer we talk here on this in this episode, I feel like in a Hollywood production, right? With ransomware negotiations. I think about Mel Gibson's Ransom. It feels very much I feel the tension. I feel the tension as you guys describe your job. It's absolutely awesome. But what I keep thinking all the time about is who are these guys? And so who are those criminals? I mean, they have to be pretty damn smart, right? I mean, to hack into a system, it's nothing that 99.9% of the global population is even capable of imagining, not even speaking about conducting such a thing, right? I mean, so they have to be smart, but at the same time, smartness has to go hand in hand with the intention or the desire to get rich fast or to capitalize on it. Could you tell a little bit more about the profile, like you just did, of Melissa and her bad friends?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that based on the work we do within Northwave, but previously I used to work for the Dutch High-Tech Crime Unit and also our National Intelligence Service. So I have a broader background and know a little bit better who our opponents actually are. Especially ransomware gangs and groups mainly originate from Russia or former Russia states. And that has to do with the fact that there are quite some advantages to do it there. They are highly educated. It's quite complex for them to find a good job on the labor market. As well, that as long as you attack organizations, Western organizations, and not Russian organizations, the Russian government will say it's okay. They will not do anything with you as a criminal, standalone, and most certainly not extradite the people to Western countries. So you're in a safe haven there. And we know, for example, based on, because that's also a quite interesting point, is that one of the groups, Conti, has been hacked themselves, because around the start of the war between Russia and the Ukraine, they supported more or less the Russian case publicly. And that was not well appreciated by, I think, one of the internal persons of Conti. And they leaked all the data, or it was hacked, internal communication of Conti. And that provides a very valuable insight on how they operate, but as well on the relations they have. And there are so many traces in there which directly point to close connections to higher FSB officials or meetings at offices of FSB officials, that we know for certain that their relation is very close. So who we're talking to, the main operators from those ransomware groups, because those ransomware groups have names. So you're talking about Lockbit or Conti or Black Cat or 8Base. But then we're talking about the encryption software and the technical platform they use. And that is dealt with and controlled with by a couple of people within that organization, up to maybe 100, who will take care of that. And that is used by another group of people. And we call them the affiliates. So they are the business partners of those ransomware groups, and they're allowed to use the platform and the software. In the end, if there is a payment, then the affiliate, so that's the actual hacker who is in your network encrypting you, will receive around 80% of the ransom which is being paid, and the operator or developer of that ransomware is actually getting 20%. And those are only two of seven roles which we distinguish in an attack. So prior to the affiliate, there is an initial access broker. So we discussed earlier, how do they actually get access to an organization? So typically people are specialized in that, and in a one-off, they will actually sell that access to the affiliates. And they have specialists in data management. So the data will be exfiltrated and then taken care of by a data manager, copied, structured, making a set of data which is very painful, like copies of passports, for example, or contracts. So the data manager is the fourth role. They have negotiators, as we do, literally. They have chasers, the more aggressive negotiators who start to hunt you digitally and put pressure on you. And they have the accountants, as we call it, and those are responsible for converting the virtual currencies in actual currencies.
Wow, that sounds like a very much or very well organized group of people who have, you know, if you're able to distribute work, if you are able to divide and specialize in highly sophisticated technology and tasks along the let's say we talk about the value chain, and this is probably value destruction chain in that case. It seems like wow, this is now I understand why Boris decided to remain Boris here in our podcast. We do have a question probably for Boris here from Pascal. What are the trigger words you look for during, once you've engaged in a communication with the hackers to ensure that you're dealing with the right people?
And it depends on what you call the right people. And the thing is, we always do the checks, as I explained before. And if they can provide a file tree of the stolen data, that means that they had access to the clients and the victim organization. So therefore, you know, you got the right person there or the right information. When you start actually negotiating about price and you see that someone has the authority to give a discount, that also helps. Furthermore, if they got a decryptor and they can actually decrypt some files, encrypted files we sent, that's another plus that we actually are dealing with the right person to actually, you know, get an organization up and running again. And these are not just words. These are like really a proof of abilities you look for. And especially if you talk about words, you know, the affiliates we have been just talked about, they can be Russian, but they can be from somewhere else around the world too. So there's so much intercultural difference between the affiliates, and it's sometimes really hard to pinpoint if you're talking to a Russian person or a Dutch or maybe say someone from Eastern Europe, and therefore it's not just words we trigger on. But I think it's a really interesting question, because even if it's just written words, from those words you can sometimes derive if someone is young or unexperienced, or very experienced, that he also knows, you know, what we are doing and you know what expectations are, and that helps. And it's strange, because normally you would think like, yeah, if you got someone on the phone, then you can hear who someone is, but even through written language, sometimes it's also possible to get a profile, and it's always hard to see if we're right, because it's you know you can't check it really. But at the same time, you can adjust to it, and that brings me to a point which is really important, because you're talking to people who actually want to communicate in a nice way as well, and it's really important to build rapport. Even with someone you think it's almost a robot, it is not a robot. It's a real person. So it's the words help to find the right position for the communication to build a report and then to get further than just the money or the time you've got to pay. You can actually start talking about other things, and I think that is the key for successful negotiations, not only in the cyber world but everywhere. Also in law enforcement, to find a connection. And that's the power of the words you use.
Yes, Boris, that's definitely very true. And what you've just mentioned resonates very strongly with the message of Gary Noesner. Gary Noesner, who was the former head of the FBI crisis unit, who shared some of his experience with our listeners and viewers a couple of weeks ago. And this is exactly what he said. Yeah? To influence somebody else's behavior, you need to get into their head. You need to build a connection, build a rapport. You need to show them that you care about what is about to happen. Yeah? So that's thank you for that, Boris. I have a follow-up question, which has been bothering me ever since we have gotten in contact. And that is, how do those negotiations actually work? Yeah? So we know one thing for sure. These guys come in probably with a demand.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, which means they have certain expectations, and most likely they make the first offers. We want, let's say, 2% of your revenue, yearly revenues, and then we decrypt your files or give you your data back. Yeah? Mm-hmm. But what happens next? How does this work? You make a counter offer, or you verify the credibility, as I understood, yes, from your answer to Pascal's question, just to make sure you're dealing with the right person. And then once they've demonstrated, okay, we have the ability to decrypt the files, or we can give you back the data that we've stolen. So what happens then?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question as well, especially because you stated that it's most likely that the threat actor gives you a ransom demand, an amount of money you've got to pay. And I know you did quite some research into the first opening bid and how powerful that can be. And I've got to say, sometimes they ask us for what we are willing to pay for it. So it's not always that they, most of the time it is, but it's not always that they will come up with a demand. But if they do, and we did the checks as explained before, then we try to make sure that the other side, the threat actor, knows that it's not very easy maybe for us to pay that money at that moment, which is absolutely reasonable because, I mean, we're talking about huge amounts of money. And therefore, sometimes you take quite a lot of time to actually explain that to them. It's a real thing, and it's not like you start talking about discounts straight away, because I mean there's so much more you can talk about than just the money, and sometimes that is aggravating the threat actor, and they will put a timer on it, say, okay, now we talked enough, we just want our money. But even then, You can tell about the problems your company has, or the ways it's really hard to finance that kind of money, or if it can be in the books or whatever. You know, there's so many things you can talk about, and personal circumstance, they can be irrelevant as well. So if you're talking to a threat actor, most people think it's about money or just time, but it can be about much more than that.
Much more than that. Yes, that makes a lot of sense, Boris. We got a follow-up question. For some reason, we cannot see the name, but it refers to a recent publication in the Dutch press. So, read an article yesterday about Dutch security services being able to react quicker to cyber attacks. How do you guys work together with the authorities, and what are the differences in scope between them and you? Very good and relevant question. Whoever it came from, it was something that I was thinking about as well, right? I mean, ransomware attacks are illegal. Yeah, this is extortion, yes, which means they should be automatically a subject to a law enforcement action, yes, which probably very rarely is. Or how does the interaction from law enforcement look like in ransomware cases?
Yeah, that literally depends from case to case. So some cases, the impact could be so high. For example, think of a hospital being attacked, or a very large logistic organization distributor is attacked. So they could be involved quite a way. But there is one, I think, important thing to understand, is that law enforcement's task is to actually identify and try to arrest a criminal. And our task is to help the organization to get back in business as quickly and securely as possible. And in the majority of the work we do, that will completely align. We have the same interests, but it also could interfere. For example, if you really would like to have all the parts of the evidence to do a proper investigation to come to the identification or the arrest of a criminal, that can take time, and that could interfere in our plan to restore as quickly as possible a backup, and that the acceptance would be that some of the forensic evidence could be lost. So that is, I think, one of the differences. As well, it's important to understand that there's a difference between a police organization and an intelligence service. So a police organization has the goal to arrest criminals for criminal offenses. And intelligence services has the authority to take care of national security. And what we have seen in the last, I think, 2 or 3 years is that this typically was the domain of the police services, but now it's also the domain of the intelligence services because of the complete destructive impact, economical impact on countries, societies. There's so much money involved, it has so much impact that as well intelligence services are involved. But they have a different interest than the police organizations. So that differs. And how do we cooperate? By default, we always will advise the clients to file a complaint with the police. We think that is quite reasonable to do so. So to provide them with all the information necessary for them to figure out what kind of groups are actually attacking Dutch organizations, for example, or German organizations. So they could actually focus on those groups who hit a country the most instead of solving every individual case, because that's almost impossible. As well, that they not necessarily will in the end come to sort of an arrest, but also would like to think of strategies, public-private partnerships, there are a lot there, to intervene in the criminal process. And one of the things we do, and I'm very proud of, we are one of the initiators there, is a project which is called Melissa. It's named after the negotiator Melissa I spoke to. And that is a public-private partnership between the Dutch police, Dutch Public Prosecutor Office, the National Cybersecurity Center, the branch organization in the Netherlands for security organizations, and a lot of incident response teams in the Netherlands. We have the goal to try to really combat ransomware by sharing information and intelligence amongst each other. And that has been quite successful. There's a formal agreement underlying there. A lot of data has been shared, which also has provided some successes in the past already. And I think that's a great way to show how we can actually align and help each other for the greater good.
Wow, that's amazing. Yes, you guys are the pioneers in the field, and it's great to hear that that you're joining forces with other actors in the scene to make sure that such instances, such cases, let's say, are able diminish or decrease or are solved or resolved quicker. That's awesome. How does we've talked about entry, we've talked about identification or verification of credentials, so to speak. We talked about the beginning of the negotiation. Let's talk a little bit about the end. As how does it? I have two questions. Number one is, how does it all end? And when there is a payout, how does it work? Are you supposed to leave a bag on off unmarked, money, right, somewhere behind the barn, right? I'm still Hollywood is in my mind. Yes, probably doesn't work like that, but nevertheless. And then, do the criminals indeed deliver on what they promise? Do they decrypt? Do they return the data? These two questions: how does it work with ransom as such? And number two is there trust among criminals?
Yeah, so first of all, there is the whole process which Boris explained about the negotiations and actually coming closer to an agreement. And once you have set that agreement, you will come to the point how to actually transfer the money, because the negotiations are in most of times in dollars, US dollars. But the payments are always in bitcoins or sometimes in moneros, which are cryptocurrencies. And it's quite hard to actually get an account to purchase cryptos. As well, or at least it's quite impossible now to do that, not for $1,000 or $2,000, but do it for a couple of millions, because that's always flagged immediately by your bank, but also by the exchange, for example. So we have a lot of procedures in place and close connections and also transparencies to so law enforcement agencies that we are doing these things and why we do that. There's a lot of control on that. But basically, before we actually come to that point, I think it's always important to understand at least one, that we always will check if it's allowed to do a payment legally. In all Europe countries, it is allowed. There's no law which says you're not allowed to pay criminals. So that is legally allowed, but that's an important question to be answered, because it's not allowed. We're not going to do it, obviously. And secondly, even if it's allowed, it could be that some of the organizations or members or groups are on sanction list, international sanction list, and they are considered then as a threat to national security or some kind of terrorist kind of threat. So what we always need to do is check the known indicators of that specific group and specific affiliates to all the relevant sanction lists to make sure that it will not pop up with a direct or an indirect link. Because if that is the case, there's a no-go for us to do the payment, not only for ourselves, but as well for our customer, obviously. Because if you do that, you can run in all kinds of additional trouble and you don't want to go there. So there are some formal procedures in place. And once that is approved or okay, then typically the customer needs to transfer the money upfront to us. And we are able to convert it and do the transaction in Bitcoins to the threat actors. Second question, what happens then? Once we have done the payment, normally quite fast, within half an hour or an hour, they will react. So we will obviously confirm or ask them to confirm that the payment has been received. We can follow that, because the strange part about cryptocurrencies is that everybody can follow each transaction online, but you don't know who is the sender or the receiver of the money, but you can follow the transaction so we can see if it actually has been received. And then what they will do is they will provide the decryptor. So they will not decrypt your information. They will send a piece of software which you can run on your systems, which contains the key so you can decrypt your systems. So that's what happens. So they're not touching your systems anymore, if that is part of the agreement. And or they will delete the data and show you some kind of log file or other kind of evidence or screen recording that they have deleted the data. Obviously, I need to make the point here that we only can see that for that set of data, but it's quite hard for us to know if there have been any copies. So, yes, we're quite sure that they will delete the data because it's part of the business model. If they would not delete the data or do something with that, and in the end, no one will pay anymore. So we're quite sure that they will do so, and they provide evidence of that. And third part, in most cases, they also will provide, they call it a vulnerability report or a report, which literally states how they were able to hack the organizations, what they have.
Really?
Yeah. And sometimes
so they even do the attacked companies a favor and help them become less prone to future attacks.
Yeah. Favor. I'm not sure if that's a favor, but at least they will tell us then how they were able to hack the organization, which is valuable information because we could either check that and reference that with our own findings of the forensic investigation. If both say the same, then it's quite certain what happened there. So that is the package deal normally you will get. The conversation with a threat actor will more or less close down.
All right, that's absolutely exciting. I keep digesting what I'm hearing from what I've been hearing from Yupim and Boris in our podcast, and I still find myself in a Hollywood movie somewhere in my mind. But okay, so we've closed the process. A threat has been removed or resolved, now let's zoom out a little bit. So what can companies do? Number one, to prevent such attacks. And number two, what shall they do when they figure out, whoops, we've been hacked? Tim, I think that's a question to you.
Yeah. So the good thing is that it's not that complex to make sure that you are actually quite adequately protected against these kinds of threat actors. Because one of the misunderstandings or misconceptions is that it's a sort of a targeted attack, that it's not the case. I told you about the role of the initial access broker. That's not the one who's going for a list and says, oh, NordWave, I want to hack NordWave. No, they try different things, send phishing emails, looking for vulnerabilities, looking for already misused passwords and accounts. And once they actually figure out one which still works, they have an entrance to the organizations, and then they qualify their lead, as I call it. So they're going to check what kind of organization did they actually have access to. And based on that, that account or access has a value. So it's quite random. So if you make sure that you're not be vulnerable for one of the three things I told you, so basically what you need to do, first of all, have the right backups, because then you always have a way to actually go back to an earlier stage. That's very important to do so. Then make sure that every single point of access from outside to the network of the organization has multi-factor authentication. So not only a username and a password, but also sort of a code, an OTP, a one-time password, or a text message which will be sent with a code. That is an additional layer of protection to prevent misuse of account takeover. Secondly, make sure that if there are updates available for software, patch it as quickly as possible. So install the update as quickly as possible, because then you are protected for that vulnerability which criminals try to exploit. So that's important. And the last part, if all those preventive measures do not work good enough, make sure you have monitoring in place. So the digital cameras in your environment. So either you can do it yourself or go to a provider as NordWave, who will have the ability to provide you with a managed SOC. And then we will put sensors in your network, monitor all your endpoints, and we will be the guards to protect you. And if we see any malicious behavior, we will act immediately upon that. So even if you then there will be some kind of infringement, it will be notified quite quickly, and then the impact will be low. Because if the mean time to detect and respond is low, then yeah, there's almost no impact from the side of the criminals.
Yes, that makes makes a lot of sense. Thank you, thank you, Pim, so much for a detailed explanation. When you look forward, right? I mean, technology is changing. So on one hand, it's easier to send and receive money anonymously. On the other hand, so cryptocurrencies are becoming more and more popular. On the other hand, technology, encrypting technologies advance. We are at the verge of having access to quantum computing, which, you know, might make decrypting easier, maybe at some point, of time. So what is your prediction with respect to the frequency and intensity of ransomware attacks in the future?
Yeah, I think quantum computing makes it easier to decrypt if it's not encrypted with quantum computing as well, because otherwise we're in the same rhetoric.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so I'm quite optimistic about that rat race, because I think in the end that the good guys will always find solutions to be protected against the bad guys, and they will always try to figure out ways to circumvent that. But that's, I think, it's a battle we need to continue to do so with all the best efforts we have. Yeah, what I would expect in the near future, yeah, the gains of these kinds of attacks are so high. There's so much money involved, and the possibility, the chance, the likelihood that you will be identified at least, or stand alone, being arrested and being prosecuted. Yeah, that's so low that it's a quite interesting business model, and there's so much money involved. And still, there are a lot of organizations who are not protected adequate, and therefore, I foresee that this will still be there around for the next decades. It might change over time in tactics. So we have seen first only the encryption, then we've seen the data exfiltration. So they will come up with new business models, I'm quite sure there. But in essence, it will be the same. Make sure you hack an organization and extort them with either data or not having access to data. So I don't see any change on the short notice there. What I do see is that more and more criminals enter this market because it's on the side of the criminals also automated. We call it ransomware as a service. So you do not need to be the smart ass anymore to be able to conduct these kinds of attacks, which is a bad thing because there are many more attacks possible, but also a good thing because more and more of our opponents actually have no clue what they're doing. So they make fuck-ups, which are easier for us to actually repair or to identify them. So it also will provide us with a lot of opportunities. But this is way from being over the next couple of years.
Yes, it's actually quite interesting what you've just mentioned, Pim. To sort of think about ransomware as a service, kind of a business model. Yes, there are all sorts of as a service business models that I have encountered in my consulting and an innovation career, but ransom as a service, I've heard it for the first time. But it makes sense, right? I mean, this allows specialization, right? And separation from development, which is highly, which is highly specialized, requires individuals with very sophisticated skills from access, which is a completely different activity. Yes, which, you know, logically, I embrace this. But it's just a surprise or just odd to think about it as a business as a service or a ransomware as a service business model. Yeah. But yes,
it's the same if you have a constructor building your house, he's not doing it himself as well. You know, he has a painter or he has a different kind of specialist helping him there. And that's in the digital world not different.
Yeah. Yes, it's you have a general. Contractor and then subcontractors specialize in their own things. Exactly. So it makes absolutely sense. So let's talk about greatness. Our question for Boris, my last question for Boris. Boris, what do you think that hackers are good negotiators?
It depends. It really depends. I encountered some really good negotiators and some really bad ones. But in general, I mean, how do you want to say if someone is good? I mean, the amount of discount, maybe that's something you can use. And the more discount they give, the worse they will be. Well, I don't think so, because it all depends on the starting bid and how you evaluate the stolen money and the necessity to actually get a decryptor. So there are so many factors to take into account to say someone is a good negotiator or not. But in the end, you always find people willing to give discounts only after a fight. You know, they if you get something for free almost, then you always are left with this feeling like, oh shit, you know, I could have gotten more out of it. Or on the other side, maybe the same. So I think it's always interesting and almost necessary to have some struggle to come up eventually with an agreement with which we are actually, you know, thinking, okay, this is acceptable, the client thinks it's acceptable, and the threat actor, which sounds really weird in a world of extortion.
It does.
It's almost like a normal business negotiation that way. But if it goes too easy, then the feeling is left, you know, this is not a good negotiator or this is not a good negotiation, maybe from our side.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know I promised it my last question to be the last, but let me follow up with another one. Yeah. Have you ever met a nice hacker negotiator, someone you actually enjoyed negotiating with, as you were talking about the amount of ransom and or discount?
Yeah. Yeah.
You did. Okay.
Yeah. I had some really nice conversations with them, and nice in the way that they actually, I had this threat actor once who said like, oh, wow, I feel I'm talking to you like a friend. And he was, you know, explaining things, how it worked, you know, and this is strange if you got like this Russian criminal image in your mind. And that's all about, you know, building the rapport and finding, you know, how to get closer to the threat actor And then the conversation doesn't have to be rough. It doesn't. You don't have to fight all the time. It can be nice. And sometimes, then, even if it's a nice conversation, it can be really effective to start arguing and maybe start fighting almost to get even a better position afterwards. So it's something you play with. It's something, you know, you can change. And I think it's much easier to do that if you you type your the conversation instead of talking on the phone with someone. You can more, I don't know, compose the message than when it's right here, right now, on the phone. You've got to do it. I had some really nice conversations as well.
Wow, that's quite amazing. It's contrary, as you correctly pointed out, contrary to our common perception of such processes, them being extremely unpleasant. Probably also we owe it to the Hollywood screen players, so to speak. All right, guys, my last question is always about greatness in negotiations. So we abandon the space of cybersecurity, ransomware negotiations, and I always ask my guests about great negotiators. So individuals who have made a significant influence, impact on you, who have impressed you, be it contemporary or historical, anyone that comes to your mind when you think about greatness?
Yeah, I think that there's always basic stuff you need to take to you to be a good negotiator. And that is, for me, the book Never Split the Difference from Chris Voss. I think he is very well known, although it's typical American, the approach, but a lot in there. It's quite useful and quite nice to understand. And I think he described a broader spectrum of different kind of negotiations, not only business negotiations, but also more police kind of negotiations. And I think that is valuable for us because we are somewhere in between. We are trying to do to fix sometimes some kind of a deal for a victim organization with criminals, and therefore both help a lot. For me, he is a great example.
All right. Boris, would you like to add someone to this list?
Not per se a name, but I always admire people who can cross boundaries. And what we're trying to do here as well is always to give training to the negotiators, which is based on law enforcement crisis communication in combination with business negotiations and academic research backgrounds. So you are able to cross the boundaries and use whatever ground you need for a good conversation. And on top of that, I can say that there are more negotiators within Northwave, and they all got like really specific backgrounds. For example, some are background in psychology or criminology or information security, name it, or crisis management. And I think the broader your basis is and the knowledge you have, the stronger you will be as a negotiator. So expand and try to cross the boundaries which are, you know, left there. And of course, I mean, Chris Voss is great, and Nusner is great, and there are so many. Even Mandela was great. You know, you can say they're all great negotiators. But I think the strongest point and the power is to make it like a one huge field to dig on and to plow on. And so I don't give you a name. I just give you an idea.
We love ideas and names together. Thank you so much, Pim. Thank you so much, Boris. To wrap it up, guys, don't let yourselves get hacked, your organizations get hacked. That's number one. Protect yourselves from threat before it's too late. But should you be exposed to a threat, yes, you know whom to call. Yes, you know that there are guys in the Netherlands, they are called Northwave, and they know a lot about how to deal with ransomware situations. You guys will find the link to their website in the comments. That's it for now. Thank you so much, Pim. Thank you so much, Boris. And until the next time on the podcast on negotiation. Thank you.